This is the poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. You know, and I know, that Washington, D.C. is a literary city. And Kim Roberts is here to tell you about it. What is your book?
The book is called A Literary Guide to Washington, D.C., Walking in the Footsteps of American Writers from Francis Scott Key to Zora Neale Hurston.
What's in it?
What's in
just
it?
In one sentence.
It is a combination of walking tours and portraits of writers of note. And it's also an anthology. It includes work by all of the featured authors. The book covers the period from the city's founding in 1800 to about 1930, to the beginnings of modernism.
Why did you begin there and why did you end there?
Because I felt like most people would not know those stories of the early history as well, and I certainly didn't. So I was really curious to find out about what the literary communities looked like in the early eras of the city. And it seemed to make sense to end it with around the time of the Great Depression, because so much in the country's identity changed after that point.
Right. Kim Roberts is here with A Literary Guide of Washington, D.C. Is there anything that exists like this at all?
No, which really surprised me. There's nothing else like this out there. And so I had to write it.
Okay. When did you start? I mean, I picture Kim walking down the street and passing Mae Miller, poet Mae Miller's house, and saying, gosh, this is the house where this famous poet lived. And then you pass another house and you think of that. Is that the way it began?
Sort of. I mean, I like that image of me passing by these houses. When I first moved to D.C., this is over 30 years ago, I started researching who were the writers who had lived here.
Why did you do that?
Sort of feel more sense of ownership of the city, to feel connected to a sense of place in the city. And, you know, of course, I didn't think I was writing a book. I just thought I was reading up on D.C. writers for my own pleasure. And so you could argue that I've been writing this book for three decades. But it wasn't until, 10 years ago that I realized that I might actually be writing a book. So I put together a series of walking tours, starting with the Walt Whitman walking tour.
What's a walking tour?
So I wanted to find the places where writers who I really admired had lived and worked, and actually go to those places. And in the case of Walt Whitman, most of those places don't stand anymore because it's the old part of the city. So he, even though I was able to find seven different boarding houses where he had rented rooms, all of them now are the site of high-rise office buildings. None of them exist.
How did you find seven boarding houses?
Well, actually, it wasn't as hard as you think. I went through his correspondence. The interesting thing is that no one had ever actually mapped these out before. And it was the correspondence with his mother that was the most helpful, because who else do you write to say, you know, the beds are lumpy, or the food is really good here, or, you know, they make me turn off the lights after a certain hour?
Where were the letters?
The letters are here at the Library of Congress, actually. One of the biggest repositories in the world for items related to Walt Whitman are housed in the Library of Congress.
This is Kim Roberts. She has a literary guide to Washington, D.C., and it chronicles all of the great people who lived here. We were never considered a literary city from outsiders. And I believe it's because we're in the shadow of the Capitol.
I think you're right.
And that's why this is a bonanza. I mean, no one, when they see under that cover all of these icons of American literature, I mean, you're really breaking ground, Kim.
Well, yes, because people do forget that, you know, Walt Whitman is associated with New York, not D.C. And in fact, once he moved here, if he had not gotten ill himself, He might have stayed on for the rest of his life. His intent was to stay. People forget that so many of the writers of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes, I'm very interested in talking about that.
That they lived here. People forget Mark Twain lived here, Paul Laurence Dunbar. It's always been this major, major literary city. And, Sinclair Lewis, the very first American writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, you know, he's associated with the Midwest. Well, he had to leave the Midwest in order to be able to write about it. And he wrote his most famous novels here. So,
do you know where he lived?
Oh, yes, of course.
Where did he live?
So I have found a couple of his addresses, that the two homes that he rented that still stand. And they are sort of greater DuPont Circle area.
And they do stand yet.
Yes, but okay. But they're, of course, not marked by any historic plaque. And one of the things that I think we're not very good in the city in claiming that that history.
Well, maybe from this book that may happen.
Maybe.
I would think
that'd
be great.
I walk past these places and I always think, do the people who live in these houses have any idea? You know, Paul Laurence Dunbar's house, one of the two houses he had in LaDroite Park is still standing, not marked by any plaque. No one would know.
This is so wrong.
I know.
This is so wrong. Kim Roberts is so right. She is with us and she has really done a sea change about our consciousness about Washington and our literary legacy. So I'm going to tell you who she is. She is, first of all, the editor and publisher of Beltway Literary Journal. What is that?
Beltway Poetry Quarterly. Sorry. Yes, it's an online literary journal that publishes writers, poets from the greater D.C. region. And it's now in its 19th year.
And do you know, I think it was Washington's first online literary journal.
Oh.
Yes, I do.
Because that it was quite might be. Yeah, we were an early adopter.
You were. And using electronics too.
Right.
So you're right.
So the first issue came out in January 2000.
Yes. And how many have there been? Is it monthly?
No. It's four times a year. It's a quarterly. So
how many poets do you think you've published?
Oh, good Lord. I have no idea. But hundreds.
So she does that. She is also the author of five books of poems, and most recently, The Scientific Method. You go toward science. You go toward research. You're kind of a scholar in poet's clothing.
I am, yes.
And you are also co-editor of the web exhibit DC Writers' Homes. That's what I want to talk about. You've been the recipient of grants, I hope, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, DC Humanities, DC Commission on the Arts. And you have been a writer in residence at 18 colonies. Tell me.
I love artist colonies.
Farthest state. What is the farthest state you've been to?
I guess that would be California.
Oh, so.
I mean, I've been to art colonies all across the U.S. I have not done any of the colonies outside the U.S. yet.
Many times I would go to G.W. Gelman Library, Special Collections, and I would see you with your head in a book. Tell us about the research, the process, and what it took for the last 10 years?
Yeah. So in order to do all the research for this book, of course, I had to go to different archives. And we are rich with good archives here in the greater D.C. area. So the Moreland Spingarn Research Center at Howard University is world-renowned. And, of course, Library of Congress, I did a lot of research there. The Washingtoniana room at the D.C. Public Library.
What were you looking for?
I was looking for personal papers on all of these authors. I also did a lot of work looking at old maps. One of the things that I found particularly challenging with the early writers was this city did not regularize its street numbering system until 1870. So any address that you have prior to that, you have to actually translate to later address. So what I mean by that is now if you have an address, say 3, 41 L Street. You know that's going to be on L Street between 3rd and 4th. But in the early days, they just numbered houses as they put them up. So it was...
That is a challenge.
Yeah.
But so, you did nail everybody.
I did.
You finally did.
I did. I was able to look at the early real estate maps and find the plat number and translate those
addresses. Do you think that you have everyone that you wanted to have up to the time you wanted to stop? Do you think that you've got
pretty much everyone? There's always more discoveries to be made. I'm especially interested in finding writers who are a little harder to dig out because they were working class women or people of color.
And they deserve to be known.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's actually some really notable early women writers who didn't publish books, but maybe published in newspapers.
And you found that through newspapers?
Right. Looking through archives of old newspapers. And there's a significant group of writers who were born enslaved, who then became writers.
Give us an example of one.
Oh.
Did you actually find the writings of these people?
Of course.
And they weren't published, so how could you find them?
Oh, well, many of them are published. One example that I have in the book is Anna Julia Cooper, who published a book of essays that is widely considered to be the very first book of feminist nonfiction written by a woman of color. And the essays are actually, they're still really good. They're still worth reading. Her book is called A Voice from the South, and it came out in 1892. You know, another example, how could we forget, is Frederick Douglass, born into slavery and became renowned for his memoirs. He was known throughout the world as an eloquent, charismatic orator.
But the women I didn't know about.
Yeah, no, so there's lots of them, and I'm still doing research. I'm still finding more and more.
And this book is into its second printing already, and it has only been out like a minute. So that is, everyone seems to understand that we cannot lose these voices. And it took someone who is so dedicated to sit in those dusty libraries. Well, some of them are pretty nice.
I have a weird temperament. I happen to think that that's fun, doing these, looking through the archives.
I was going to ask you.
So I was going to say also, you know, so I've certainly worked in all of the archives locally, but I've also done some traveling to, you know, not all of D.C. writers' archives ended up here in D.C. So one of my favorite places that I've been to now a couple of times is the Beinecke Library at Yale University. And boy, is that a gorgeous place to do research.
Did you get some help along the way from funding?
I've gotten some grants that have also helped out quite a bit. I actually, in April of 2019, I got a grant to be a visiting scholar at Emory University.
Coming up.
Yeah. So I'll be looking at their archives. You had mentioned Mae Miller. Her papers are at Emory. They're not here. So that's among one of the writers that I'll be looking at for the couple of weeks that I'll be down there.
There's no end to this.
There is no end to this.
I'm beginning to see that. Yeah. Kim Roberts, you have started something big. And would you give us a taste of the book?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So who shall I start with?
How about Walt?
Okay.
We all know. Now tell us who he was, because some people may have thought he was an uncle of somebody. So Walt Whitman, set him up.
Sure, of course.
19th century.
Walt Whitman lived in D.C. for 10 years, from 1863 to 1873. And he is deservedly well known as the author of the masterpiece Leaves of Grass, a volume of poems that he re-edited and republished numerous times between 1855 and 1891. He also wrote Drum Taps, Memoranda During the War, and Specimen Days, which are all about his experiences during the Civil War. And he came to D.C. to volunteer as a nurse. He visited patients in over 50 temporary Civil War hospitals set up around, across the city.
He tended them.
And long after the Civil War ended, he continued to write and publish on the war's impact on American identity. He even claimed that Leaves of Grass would not have been written had it not been for his wartime experiences, despite the fact that three earlier editions of Leaves of Grass had already been published by the time he moved to D.C.
Oh, well.
but he really, for him, the Civil War and how the nation reacted was more revealing of American identity than any other time that he had lived through.
Do you know Daniel Mark Epstein?
Oh, sure.
Okay, his book about Lincoln says that when Lincoln was writing the Gettysburg Address, Leaves of Grass was open on his desk, and he tracks the phraseology. Wow. So that Lincoln was very impressed by Whitman. Let us hear some Walt Whitman.
Okay, so this is a short poem of his, When I Heard at the Close of the Day. When I heard at the close of the day how my name had been received with plaudits in the Capitol, still, it was not a happy night for me that followed. And else, when I caroused, or when my plans were accomplished, still, I was not happy. But the day when I rose at dawn from the bed of perfect health, refreshed, singing, inhaling the ripe breath of autumn, when I saw the full moon in the west grow pale and disappear in the morning light, when I wandered alone over the beach and undressing, bathed, laughing with the cool waters, and saw the sun rise. And when I thought how my dear friend, my lover, was on his way coming, oh, then I was happy. Oh, then each breath tasted sweeter. And all that day my food nourished me more, and the beautiful day passed well, and the next came with equal joy. And with the next at evening came my friend. And that night, while all was still, I heard the waters roll slowly, continually, up the shores. I heard the hissing rustle of the liquid and sands as directed to me, whispering to congratulate me. For the one I love most lay sleeping by me under the same cover in the cool night. In the stillness, in the autumn moonbeams, his face was inclined toward me, and his arm lay lightly around my breast. And that night, I was happy.
What a wonderful poem. We should point out that he was one of the first poets who used the long line and just more like you spoke than a very tight formalism, but it is very lyrical, very right. lyrical. Right. Kim, what was the Harlem Renaissance?
Oh, so that is a horrible name for a very important movement, the earliest modernist movement during the Jazz Age. I say it's a horrible name because Harlem Renaissance implies that it only happened in New York, and that was a name that was given to the movement much later. But actually, the movement that we now call the Harlem Renaissance was happening in many cities simultaneously, and you could argue that the movement actually started in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. was an important city for people of color after the end of Reconstruction because it had some of the best schools when schools were segregated for students of color, including Howard University, It had a variety of prestigious and good-paying jobs, including jobs with the federal government that were open to people of color. It was a place where a large African-American population, especially the intellectuals and the writers, centered around institutions such as the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, the American Negro Academy, Howard University, and M Street High School, the forerunner to today's Dunbar High School, which was the top school for students of color in the nation. And so, you know, it was a sort of
It was the focus. It was a real fulcrum.
Yeah. And unlike in New York, it was a city that also it was affordable for people of color to buy property, which is extremely important, so that there was this entrenched middle class.
Give us the dates.
Oh, so when we talk about the Harlem Renaissance, we're talking actually for a fairly short period of time in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Sterling Brown was a primary figure.
Right, although he was young during the Harlem Renaissance. But yes, he was part of that group. But the names that are going to be most recognizable, I think, to most people would be Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, who both lived here. And it was while living here that he got a contract for his first book of poems and finished that book, and then wrote most of the poems for his second book as well. So his time here was crucial for his development.
And Washington has been a nourishing place for writers. But, you know, we've never had this assemblage before. It's shocking to me that no one took the time. You had to be a writer yourself, as you are, Kim, I think, really to be propelled to want to bring these voices to the fore. You had to be a poet yourself to know what it takes to live in this city. Read us a little bit more from the book.
Okay. One of the most important extant sites of the Harlem Renaissance in any city, I would argue, is the home of Georgia Douglas Johnson. And she is a hero of mine.
Tell us about her.
So she was an older writer during the Harlem Renaissance period. And she opened her house up weekly for what she called the Saturday Nighters. And it was a literary salon in her home. And it was a place where writers who usually work in isolation could come together, share works in progress, encourage one another. And evidently, she was a marvelous hostess. The poem I'm going to read is called Common Dust.
Andrew's here.
No. It's the book is spread. There are five different chapters, and it goes chronologically. Uh-huh. So the first chapter is before the Civil War. The second chapter is the authors who lived in D.C. in the Civil War and the years immediately afterwards. Then we have the Gilded Age, Reconstruction, and then the Jazz Age.
Read us a little bit more from the book.
Okay. Well, so since we're here lies one unlabeled. The world at large, his home. Can one then separate the dust? Will mankind lie apart when life has settled back again the same as from the start?
That is wonderful. Say her name again.
Georgia Douglas Johnson.
Read us one more, please.
Okay. I will read actually a little prose because I can't resist bringing in the voice of Frederick Douglass. This is just a paragraph from an essay that he wrote called A Lecture on Our National Capital.
Just quickly tell us who he was.
Oh, of course. Frederick Douglass, most famous for his memoirs, A Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, An American Slave, My Bondage and My Freedom, and The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. Oh, and I should mention, Douglass's house in Anacostia, in D.C., is preserved by the National Park Service. It contains his original furniture, his books. It's an incredible collection. They've even recreated his studio, a windowless stone room that he called the Growlery out in the backyard. If you haven't been there, I highly recommend the tour. 2018 is the 200th anniversary of Frederick Douglass's birth.
Let's hear a little bit.
Okay. He writes, "A very brief acquaintance will convince one that Congress is not the place for either a vain man or a weak man. He may be a very great man at home and a very small man in Congress. It is one thing to be weighed and measured by one's friends, neighbors, and admirers, but quite another thing to be measured in comparison with the chosen representatives of 40 millions of people. Mm. In this presence, your weak man will easily sink to nothingness, and your vain man, if not hopelessly blind and insensible, will have his vanity completely taken out of him. He will be allowed to pass in a crowd, but will find no admiring eyes feasting upon his fine face, his fine figure, or his fine clothing. The people there gathered are accustomed to hear and see great men. They are experts. They know at a glance the genuine from the spurious, the false from the true, the sheet iron thunder of the stage from the royal thunder of heaven."
What a writer.
He's incredible. I also would like to remind you that Washington, D.C. was allowed to offer a statue in National Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol. Finally, after a long fight, every state had one, had two statues. We had nothing until finally we got a statue, and the person representing D.C. in National Statuary Hall is Frederick Douglass.
Thank you, Kim. Let us have a final poem.
Okay.
And say one more time the title of this groundbreaking book.
The book, thank you. The book is A Literary Guide to Washington, D.C. And I'm going to end with a short poem by Anne Lynch Botha, who was here prior to the Civil War. She lived in D.C. from 1850 to 1853 while serving as personal secretary to Henry Clay. And she later moved to New York, and she also ran a salon out of her home that was extremely important. It was very popular with the American Transcendentalists. So, I'm amazed that we don't remember her poetry better. It is, I think, incredible. She's one of the top American women poets of the Federalist period. She's rarely taught.
Say her name again.
Anne Lynch Botha.
We won't forget it.
So this is a very short poem of hers. It's called To an Astronomer. "Upon the professor will waste not a glance, since he has no eyes for us poor terrestrials. With his heart, can we have any possible chance when he gives us for rivals a host of celestials? What cares he for eyes, whether hazel or blue, or for any slight charms such as we share between us, when, his glass in his hand, he can sit the night through and ogle at leisure Diana and Venus?"
That is the voice of Kim Roberts, and it is so wonderful to bring writers that let us know we are part of them, they are part of us. She's made that happen. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the Sinipid Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.